Hey friends, it's Eric Sorensen, co-host of 30 Minutes in the New Testament, here with a special announcement. And that announcement is that 30 Minutes in the New Testament can now be found on YouTube. If you click on the link in the show notes here just below me, you're going to see that we have our own YouTube page. And the reason we're doing that is because from now on, we're going to be recording not just audio of the episodes, which will continue on the various podcast platforms that you use, but we're also going to film our episodes so that you can access video. And so make sure to click on that link, subscribe today so you can keep up with all the clips we release and all our future episodes. Thanks so much.
Hello and welcome to the Thinky Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb Keith, and the Thinky Fellows is brought to you by the 1517 Podcast Network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of the shows there. There are a lot of podcasts. So if you finish this one and you're looking for something to listen to later this week, you might pick one of the other shows that some of the hosts on the Thinky Fellows co-host as well. Today I'm joined by Scott Keith, my father. He also co-hosts Tough Texts.
And now 30 Minutes in the Old Testament.
And in the New Testament.
New Testament, shoot.
And so you can check those out, be in the show notes below. Tough Texts goes through difficult, obscure passages in the Bible and tries to help people navigate them. And then he's a guest on 30 Minutes in the New Testament for the next
year
or so. And they go through the New Testament verse by verse, and he's starting with Dan Price and Eric Sorensen on the book of Matthew. I'm also joined by Adam Francisco, co-host of the Faith and Reason Exchange. You can check that out in the show notes below. That is a more apologetics and obviously, as the name implies, faith and reason, centered podcast. You get explicit subjects on that kind of topics on that kind of subject. So go check that out. And Bruce doesn't co-host any other shows. And we're joined by Bruce Hemley today. Guys. No,
I host my own.
He does host his own show on Twitter and soon to be on more video platforms. I believe
it's called X.
It is called X, but nobody, everybody knows it's Twitter. It's actually still like twitter.com too.
Yeah.
So, but yes, Bruce co-hosts the Gray Space thing. I just saw your latest episode yesterday in my feed. So I think something, the subject line was about church denominations disagreeing about doctrines. And so interesting videos over there. So if you're on Twitter/X, you can check out Bruce's videos. And we are working on bringing those to more platforms in the future.
And his recent Academy course is out and people should check it out.
That's true. Bruce has an academy on the early church, which is very excellent. It's very high production value, very easy to watch and follow. So if you've heard about our academies in the past and you're wondering about them, it's academy.1517.org is the link there. You can create an account. You can sign up for any of these free courses. Costs no money at all. And Bruce's is the newest one, and I think it would be a great one to start with because, like I said, it's very easy to follow and watch, and the production value is extremely high. So I think people will enjoy that. All right, guys, we're doing a topic that Adam picked yesterday because I'm on top of it. And
I didn't really pick it. I threw it. And
how many more do we?
I think you guys worked on like 15.
Like 15 or 20 of them by the end.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. I totally ignored all of your texts yesterday, so I didn't see any of it.
Adam and I make magical lists. That's what we do.
That's good. I mean, that's very helpful. I made a list in December and my list ran out, and so I'm thankful for whatever list you guys can come up with. But I liked several of the topics that you guys threw out there. I thought they would be relevant. And Adam's today is a good question, which is, can you be, I guess it's probably a should you be, because people can always find a way to answer yes to the can question, but can you be a Christian and a materialist / did you put Darwinist on there? Something to that extent.
Yeah.
So I guess there's a couple ways to phrase this, right? Are Christianity and materialist worldview compatible? I guess this has the question of, can you believe in evolution or teach evolution and be a Christian? There's a couple of like loaded questions in here, but maybe Adam, you can specify what you mean by materialist, because I think we've given it definitions in the past that would identify materialism as a distinct religious ideology or religion-like ideology. And so there's some sort of face value here where the immediate answer is probably no, but I guess we're also hinting at pieces of materialism that Christians might pick up.
Yeah, well, I'm not, this is a way to kind of maybe protect me a bit. I'm not really interested in a modern sense. I was asking, throwing it out there, because I'm in the middle of doing a little bit of research, and I'm curious to see Scott's reaction. I have been doing a deep dive into Franz Pieper's Christian Dogmatic.
Wow.
And
should we pull it off the shelf?
No.
Okay.
But, you know, it's interesting as I have the set and volume one, because it always sat next to my cheap leather-bound NASB Bible, or maybe it's the ESV that I bought years ago. And in Irvine, I think somewhere in a box, the heat caused the leather, because it was cheap leather.
Leather?
My Pieper. So, and it's been like that for 10 years. Uh-huh. Almost as long as I've owned Costco Kirkland brand shirts.
It's almost like the Bible was trying to make its way into Pieper.
Yeah. No. But every time I open it, I'm always like picking at this leather. Finally, this morning, I cleaned it off. So now it's nice. Oh, but anyway, the reason why I'm doing that is because I'm curious about I've been thinking about and doing some research into the Lutheran dogmatic tradition. And I'm wanting to know about 19th century German Lutherans. And in particular, there's a guy named Otto Zöckler. There's an umlaut over the O, or you can just put an E after the O, who wrote extensively on the issue of science and theology. He's the first, certainly the first German, but probably the first Christian to actually address Darwinism at length and on Darwinian terms. Even wrote a letter, or more than one letter, to Charles Darwin. So, and one of the big issues he was addressing in 19th century Germany was this very question, can a Christian be a materialist, which was already popular in Germany before Darwin's writings get translated and read by the German public? And then by extension, can a Christian be a Darwinist? And Otto Zöckler was part of the confessional, if you will, Lutheran tradition. Though Pieper wasn't a big fan of Zöckler on some fronts. And for Zöckler, one of his biggest issues was trying to persuade faithful Christians in Germany, do not fall for the philosophy or worldview of materialism. Be wary of it. And Darwinism, while he was very respectful of Darwin and natural sciences, he was very quick to point out the holes, the scientific and philosophical holes that Darwinism and /materialism had. So that's why I posed the topic, because I thought it was interesting. Now, it was kind of a joke that I was trying to protect myself about this by just, you know, the question arising from historical interests. I think this is a big issue today. I think the answer is obvious. Can a Christian be a materialist? If we take materialist in the normal sense of the term, that is somebody who believes that the only thing that exists is matter, energy, space, and time. That's it, and it's existed for all eternity. There is no God. Obviously, you can't be an atheist and a Christian at the same time. Where things get a little sticky, though, is if materialism is kind of like the more extreme or ideological form of naturalism. I think we could kind of describe it that way. Is can a Christian be a naturalist? Now, it all depends on how you define naturalism, right? There are plenty of Christians working in the natural sciences who are not naturalists in their worldview, like in a worldview that kind of comes close to materialism, but who would say, and we know some of them, at universities, right, who would say a Christian can operate as a natural scientist, but they have to follow the rules of science. And the rule of science is methodological naturalism, mm-hmm. where they kind of protect themselves, if you will, from scrutiny by saying we're only operating with a method that is naturalistic, not an the big term or philosophical term would be ontology that's naturalistic. And that's, there's a lot of room for discussion there. And there's, of course, lots of debates over that. To put another plug in, even though you did already, Caleb, for Faith and Reason Exchange, David Anderson and I did a whole show on methodological naturalism, where we talked about how, while it makes sense that the natural sciences seek, especially when you, if science is now demarcated as simply the exploration of the natural world, it makes sense you would follow methodological naturalism. But once the natural sciences begin to explain more, that's when it all of a sudden moves into, and it can do it very, I guess, unconsciously, into an ontology or a worldview that is becomes more and more naturalistic. So that's what I was thinking is when I threw out the idea.
So
now, I like some of Bruce's ideas better. Maybe lists are more magical in mind.
Well, I was going to say, when...
Are you reading paper? Did you?
No, I did not pull paper off the shelf. Call me so. When you were looking into sort of the old, the 19th century dogmaticians, did you run across Luthart at all?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he's got all I was going to say is I thought I had Zöckler on the shelf. That's why I was scrimmaging through the shelf, and that might be up there, but I knew I had the Luthart on there, and he deals with that in several of his lectures. Two that are in his, the Fundamental Truths of Christianity, too. Yep. So,
yeah, this is more, it's interesting. The book I'm reading, the author makes the point that 20th century modern theology, so like the big names would be, Bultmann, mm-hmm. Paul Tillich, and, Bruce's favorite, Karl Barth, not the Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. President, but the Swiss German speaking Karl Barth, who's probably the most influential theologian in the 20th century, right? But this book makes the point that their theology in the 20th century was largely built on the foundation established in the 19th century that theology was established by its interaction with the rise and prestige of the natural sciences in the German universities. And you get it's a mixed bag. One of the things about doing this research, not that anybody should care about this so much, but it opens up all kinds of Pandora's boxes. Because you get probably the first to address it is, what's his middle, David Strauss. I think it's David Friedrich Strauss, who wrote the Old and the New Faith and is largely connectable, not largely. He's like one of the fathers of the search for the historical Jesus. Who basically came to the position that natural sciences has shown that the traditional doctrines of Christianity just simply can't pass muster. And so he works at completely reinventing Christianity as more about an existential sort of thing rather than a confession about what happened in time and space or how God has promised and revealed himself in time and space. But then you got the complete opposite, this guy Otto Zöckler, who maintains traditional historic Christianity in view of conflict, maybe it's too strong a word, but it's apropos here of the natural sciences, which we're now so accustomed to thinking that we've got to we did an episode on the science, right? We've got to give the consensus in science, whatever that is, like we got to tip our hat at it. But in the 19th century, that was something how people responded to the rise and the burdens of the sciences, the queen of the sciences really kind of lays down a trajectory or establishes a trajectory that we're kind of in these days.
Don't you think it's, you know, rises quickly or is easy to spread this sort of mix of materialism into the faith so that a question like this happens? Because there's some sort of like daily interaction with the benefits of materialism. So that if, you know, somebody says, well, why is your life better or higher quality of life now than 100 years ago? Is it because we stopped exploring spiritual explanations for things like disease and human suffering and instead turned to material solutions? So even if I think there's something beyond this life, you know, that might be in a box over here, but as far as my concerns and my needs here now, they're being answered by materialist, you know, methodology quicker and more effectively than they were ever answered by a spiritual worldview.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that to put yet another plug for Faith and Race Exchange, especially the episode on methodological naturalism. And don't shake your head at me.
I was like, it's almost a Faith and Reason Exchange episode anyway, so just go for it.
It's you got to be careful that it just is a method, because methods, epistemologies always have ontological strings attached, I think.
Does that add, I'm just going to put you on like a bit of trial here, does that add complications for like the particular type of apologetics that we engage in, where you're using, you know, materialistic methodology to investigate the history of the past and to sort of determine what's true or not?
Yeah, you have to be careful. So on your point about the benefits of materialist science or whatever, years ago there was a lecture given by a guy named David Menton, now deceased. He worked out of that group. Answered in Genesis. He was like the sole Lutheran in that bunch, right? And he was an award-winning geneticist, Washington University, the so-called Harvard of the Midwest, St. Louis. And he made the point throughout his lecture that all of his success in science at, you know, the highest levels of academia, which aren't all that high despite common assumptions, but all that success and all the accolades he won, none of his scientific research presupposed a naturalistic or a materialistic worldview. He could make, I mean, he was like a hardcore young earth. This is an exaggeration, but he thought that he could give you almost the precise age of the earth. That's how hardcore he was in his creationism or his young earth creationism. He said he could operate with that worldview and still do science and make all sorts of scientific advances or help in advancing science, especially in the realm of genetics, with that worldview, using the method, the naturalistic methods. But the point he made, though, is in working in science, you've got to be careful that that methodology does not force you to put your Christian worldview in a box, as if they're two separate watertight compartments. You know, you operate in your day-to-day life as essentially a practical atheist, but maybe on Sunday morning, what it leads to is doing that, and then on Sunday morning for an hour and a half, you're a Christian theist or something.
So
his argument was to blend the two, that one could do both.
So since our listeners aren't as sophisticated as Faith and Reason Exchange listeners are, maybe we should
thanks for another plug.
Define what we're talking about.
Know the best
with the strict materialism here. It's just, if you, and correct me if I'm going to define this incorrectly, but it's assuming that God, if there is such thing, is never the answer to the question, and then operating to find the answers to the questions only with the thing that you can observe / interact with according to your five senses.
Yeah. But you can't have a God in a strict materialism, right? You can't even posit it.
You can't, okay, in a strict, but even as like most sort of scientists who are agnostic and materialists, they wouldn't say you can't. They just say you operate as if it doesn't make
sense.
You know,
yeah.
And no, well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I don't even know if it's that. Maybe, but even with an honest sort of atheist scientist, I don't think that most of them these days are going to force you to be an atheist or to say operate as though, you know, when we're looking for answers to questions, we don't say, well, let's put God in the mix as a possible answer, or a God, or divine being, or what, a first cause, whatever you want to call it, out there. So is that, I mean.
But the method doesn't allow that, right, Adam, to your point? The method itself just doesn't allow that.
Correct.
That's so there. That's my
yeah,
point.
So I think the answer, like, can you have a Christian worldview and also pursue the natural sciences following methodological naturalism? The answer is yes. And in many ways, we're kind of the beneficiaries, as Caleb kind of hinted at earlier, of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a world in which, or not a world, which Christians haven't benefited from the advancements of materialist worldview.
Let me say this in a way that I think people might relate to. When the geeks over at Apple are trying to fix the autocorrect on my text, which they should really do a better job with that, just by the way. Autocorrect on Apple messaging seems to get worse with every update. I don't know how it's possible, but it just seems to be true. But when they're trying to fix it and make it better, you don't, even if they're a Christian, you don't want them necessarily, like, you know, praying ahead of time that God reveal to them the answer to making the messaging app better so that the autocorrect works. You would,
why not?
I'm saying this methodological part here. I'm saying you'd prefer that they sort of just do that you trust that God has put them in this vocation because they can do the math and write the code to make it better. That you're not looking for outside revelation from God straight into their head give them the answer, that God has, you know, endowed them with the abilities and they have gotten the education so that they can do the math and write the code and finally fix this autocorrect on iMessage.
I kind of think, as somebody who has such a big autocorrect answer, you should be pleading with God to directly inspire the developers at Apple to fix it. I mean,
I can't be the only one that's noticed this.
Examples in my head, but I dare not utter them because the words it corrects are not the words.
I do not like that the iMessage really discourages me from cussing in my messages. I don't like it at all.
It's because there's a Pentecostal software developer.
I don't know what it is, but it's really strange. It's really strange. But that's it, right? Is it we benefit from the fact that people do the work with the assumption that an answer can be found by doing the math, observing the data. We benefit from that rather than sort of just all like monks in a corner praying for God to inspire them with the answer. Correct?
Yep.
Okay.
I think I remember reading.
Or Yah. Do you want a German? Yah.
Yeah.
I remember reading a while ago something by, the great forest of eyebrows, Rowan Williams, on this, and the former Archbishop of Canterbury, and a great scholar and theologian, who can get progressive at times, but also has his foot deeply in the tradition, which is helpful because he really has a wide understanding of that. And he had made a warning against talks against materialism. And now he's not talking about it in the strict materialism of there's no God, obviously. But he was saying, if you reject materialism too much, you just get to Gnosticism. And you get to the aisle of the body and...
Yeah.
And kind of
stuff. I feel like the key is in the word strict.
Yeah. Well, it's a spectrum, I guess.
Well, this is why I like Adam's addition of maybe like Darwinism or finding another ism in here, because in many ways Christians are some of the first ones to actually like honor the creation and see the gifts of creation as something for people to cultivate for the sake of their neighbor or themselves and the good of the world, right? You know, a lot of early scientific discoveries that the rest of the sciences are built on happened by Christians. A lot of medicine, originally hospitals, like things that we take as strictly material today, were not always so.
Williams goes in this talk. So maybe as you get older, your eyebrows will grow wise, like his as well. But he does talk about, and to Adam's point, he talks about how, you know, science or naturalism, maybe, I don't think he used the word naturalism, though, but I think he meant naturalism. But like science and theology don't have to be fundamentally opposed, because Christians can affirm a level of materialism. In fact, they have to, because God is creator and God, you know, resurrects the body. But of course, that can always slip too far into a denial of God in exchange for only materialism. And that's when he actually argues, like, it does violence to ethics. Like, the human person stops being anything other than a material thing, and therefore loses its intrinsic rights and other things, because it's no different than a blade of grass. I mean, what, cut it down? Like,
yeah, I mean, isn't that the, like, one of the easiest holes to poke into a strict materialist? Is that, I mean, ethics are not material. Yeah, like, the boundaries of their identity. Yeah, the mind. Their self-identity is not
material. Well, it's like a strict materialist making a case for man-caused global climate change. I always try to get that right. And then trying to argue from that to what I ought to do about it. You know,
I mean, human being caused.
Sorry. Human being caused global climate change. It's so hard to get that right. And then, you know, trying to transfer from that to convincing me that I have a moral obligation to do something about this.
Right.
It doesn't work.
You ask yourself.
Yeah. You could, the only thing, you know, even materialism would struggle with this, but you could maybe use some sort of consequentialism on it for me if the impact of this human being caused global climate change, hey, that was better, is going to happen now and it's going to directly affect me.
That's still not material.
Materialism.
The second you've done consequentialism, yeah, you're not.
It's not possible. You just can't do it. So that's the problem with all the stricts, right? I love empiricism. Strict empiricism, not so much. Like, right. If you're a rationalist, strict rationalism, that's not going to take you very far. Materialism, are there some benefits to, like, the methodologies that have been derived from it? Sure. I mean, we've got a lot of scientific and technological advances that have likely come about because of people's focus on trying to find the answers here within the natural world. But strict materialism, I mean, I think the example that I just gave is where you see strict materialists running up into the uttermost boundaries of what they're able to do with their worldview. And they find it wanting, and so they start going in over into ethics where they have no experience, and so they do it real badly.
I feel like this is one of those areas where, you know, philosophy makes things worse. Like, things that are just natural and sort of apparent to people, which is, you know, there's more than just the physical, and also you engage with the physical, and when you investigate or work with the physical, that's what you're doing. It's just kind of like, it's stuff you all do until some philosopher tells you to, comes and says, and that means God is dead, you know? And it's, yeah, like,
yeah,
it's just, it's bizarro. And I always think too, you know, like the other part of me goes, the reason that this gets into the worldview stuff or the religion stuff is somebody at the top, somebody who engages in this alternative philosophy, alternative religion, wants to get rid of something that Christianity and the other religions impose on the world. And usually it's some weird sex thing or,
yeah,
like something else. It's just like, Christianity doesn't allow me to do this, so I'm going to work backwards until it's gone. And like 90% of the time you find somebody who is working to destroy Christianity through atheism and materialism. And it's because of some weird ethical thing. Mm-hmm. I mean,
that's even, I don't know if you ran into this at the university, Adam, but I sure did teaching the basic theology class. Anytime you'd get a freshman or a transfer student who, and it wasn't that common, but really despised Christianity for some reason, and would write a term paper on, like, you know, the objective nature of evolution, or evolution as fact, not theory, something that they thought was really brilliant. At the end of the day, it became an argument for Christianity tells me that I can't X, Y, or Z, and I really don't like it, so let me write this term paper backwards to try to convince you of it from a whole other angle. And it's like, okay.
Well, on the other side of the history of it, though, to go back to this 19th century stuff, so Darwin writes his Origin of Species in the 1850s, then Descent of Man is 1871, and this guy, Zockler, you know, he keeps up with all this stuff. In fact, his biographer suggests that he prided himself on staying up to date on all the the latest publications and so on. He writes
a chairman like, who prided himself on being really smart.
Well, this is the age of like this.
No way.
The rise of the German professoriate, you know, where it's like you got to get two doctorates and be like the expert on all the minutiae in your particular field. But he says, like 2 years after the Descent of Man, he says, the English have done, English speaking people over the British Isles have done a pretty good job in combating materialism, though it continues to run amok in the universities. He goes, in Germany, it's increasingly taking over our culture. He goes, and as materialism is elevated to the status of an overarching authority, an ideology, a worldview, there will be less and less room for truth and goodness. And if materialism begins to inform, as it already is, he says, culture and ethics and those things, there will be nothing that will keep us from pursuing tremendous amounts of evil. And that's why historically why it was such a big, one of the reasons why it's a big deal. And I think it's, the issue of worldview, while it can be just like this dry academic thing, is worldviews are very, determinative might be too strong of a word, because I don't think people are really conscious of their worldviews and are very consistent with their worldviews, but they provide these lenses, and they're kind of like software in that they inform our decision making and our assessment of things, and they can have, to parrot the phrase of Richard Weaver, ideas have consequences, and they can be catastrophic, harmful, or otherwise. So the point about all this, though, is with respect to materialism / naturalism, or we could throw another ism out there, physicalism, right? Is that science is a great gift. God's created us with our reason and our sense experience and still preserves them, right? But science informed by a larger worldview, let's say like the Christian worldview, is in a much better position to speak to navigate the complexities of immaterial things than, say, a reductionist worldview like materialism that makes all these ethical and immaterial claims, but it has no basis from which it makes those claims. It's a recipe for disaster.
I mean, this reminds me a bit also of our kind of technology episode where it's like, talk about is technology good or bad, and we end up basically talking about the use and users of it. You can see that, like, scientific advancement or exploration could be limited by ethical concerns, so that you hit the brakes at some point, right? And that's always the fear I hear about Christians or imposing their worldview on science and our progress, right, is that it will hit the brakes on certain things. And I think you do have to do some work on convincing people that the good has to come before the technological progress. And I think we're often in the position of just the opposite, which is scientific exploration should be unlimited, and then we should ask, is it good or bad later?
And that's C.S. Lewis's point in The Abolition of Man, or his warning. It's the last chapter, he ends with something like, we desire a people who can make all these decisions, but we don't in our educational system provide them the tools to think about things apart from just the technique and the material science behind it.
Yeah.
We create a generation of men without chests, as he put it. We would like to say on this podcast, human beings without chests, but...
Where do people...
We desire, countries full of ethicists, and we train and educate engineers. I mean, it's just...
Well, if we're lucky, we get them.
Yeah.
I mean, there's wrapped up in a whole host of things, right? Like, is your national security dependent on having a huge group of engineers more than ethicists, right? And things.
Well,
like
I mean,
and
I think for the sake of
social justice warriors, can you
imagine? I mean, I'd like to have maybe a couple of people in the room who have a solid moral compass when we're deciding about the end of the world. I mean,
Yeah.
I mean, maybe if there's 20 people in that room, maybe three.
Oh, I'm not advocating for it. I'm just saying, like, you can see the logic, which is if we need the biggest bombs, right? If we're going to stay, your focus ends up pumping the engineers.
I guess the question that that leaves me with is, where do people become a materialist? Is it the classic kind of Christian, like, those damn universities kind of like
thing? No, I think like, it's those damn kindergartens.
Like, where is materialism just, like, taking over? Since all the way in the early 1900s, already taking over. But now, like, if we still think we're dealing with this problem of Christian people, getting inundated with not just materialist methodology, but materialist worldview and maybe even religion, winning out, where is it happening?
Well, if you ask Charles Taylor, which is what he's done a lot of his work in this area, he would tell you that's modernity and that it's the loss of transcendence. So when you lose transcendence as a culture and you no longer have faith in transcendence, then you're left with materialist. And when you add to the fact that you have a scientific revolution that gives greater weight to materialism while simultaneously losing transcendence, then that's where it comes from. I mean, I'm simplifying Taylor, but that's essentially what he...
Well, at least somebody's simplifying something today. At the end of the day, there's a lot going on here, right? There's sort of a long, historically, and I'm not the historian, so I'll defer to Adam, but historically, there's sort of a long slog from the Renaissance to postmodernism that's sort of just like, it's an evolution in many terms sort of away from transcendence that kind of takes a very long time, right? It takes hundreds of years. And we're sort of at that, even Bruce was saying before the show, sort of postmodern, we're kind of where we go next from here now that that project seems like it's had its way with us is a big question. But at the end of the day, if we're talking about this sort of the impact that this has on Christians, I think just the years of everybody going through an educational process that sort of assumed materialism, including Christians, has made it that, and I think Adam made this point either on mic or off mic a couple weeks ago, that one of the big issues is just how much Christians live these bifurcated lives right now, right? So where you really can sort of, in our world today, just go to church on Sunday, be a Christian, you know, probably even and likely even believe that Jesus died for your sins and have your faith in him is going to save you, but interact with that massive, you know, ultimate truth on Sunday only, and then deal with the rest of your life, you know, the other six and three quarter days of the week, operate as if it doesn't really matter. And when you do that, sort of the materialism, I think, just becomes as organic to you as it is to most people. You're not even thinking about it. You're not making a decision to be a materialist. It's just, it's the water in which you swim. You kind of come out of that water into a different water for a very short period of time, one day a week, but then you're right back into that water. And I don't know. I think that way, because I've been thinking about this like with parenting and stuff too. I think the same is true with parenting and a lot of things.
How do you think people actually do that?
Do what?
What does that contradiction look like in like real life?
So oh, I don't. Church, I don't know that it's a contradiction properly. It's a bifurcated life in that sort of the your focus on operating with things that you think are true, or at least operate as though they are true on Sunday, you know, sort of the ultimate truth that you're operating with and the truth about Christ's death and resurrection for you and its implications on your life are just very time limited as opposed to sort of the way you deal with everything else. How would that bleed? You know, why? I think even 30 years ago, it was less bifurcated than it is now because of faith made it into more aspects of your life. Maybe it was in your schooling. Maybe it was around the dinner table more than it is. Maybe it was, you know, d- during a devotion. Maybe it was just in casual conversations as you were driving with your dad on the freeway more than it is now. I just think that it's made its... I remember it being, you know, way more a part of sort of the everyday your faith, at least, and the implications that it had on your life outside of the church building, way more...
I think you have to make people comfortable. Like, so I agree. I mean, I can't time travel back 30 years, so, but memory-wise, but I think...
it's because you're a baby.
Yes, because I'm little. But I think you have to, like this, you know, it's going to sound cliche or something like that, but there's a catechesis issue in the sense that we've talked about before, which is people are not comfortable or used to talking about the faith. We are used to talking and hearing about basically everything else.
Technology,
politics, the material. And part of the normal...
Human-caused global climate change.
Mm-hmm. And so to re-enter the vocabulary, it has to be used more frequently. In order to be used more frequently, it has to re-enter the vocabulary. I think you kind of have this, like, catch-22 circle, chicken-egg circle going on. But I think that just starts with the people who are recognizing it now, people like the listeners of these kinds of podcasts, intentionally then not just... you know, listening to this in their earbuds, but then talking to their family, their friends with religious language and religious implication and Christian language and Christian implication, ethical questions run through the Decalogue and through Scripture and stuff like that intentionally, not just assumed that that's how we do it and saying that we are doing it out loud.
It's got to be part of the home, whatever that home looks like, and the culture of that home. I mean, it's you. The word you used earlier was catechesis, and I don't think there's a cookie cutter form of it. But and I'm not like in the past. I've been a little, you know, I get a little tired of the emphasis on, and especially using the ecclesiastical language. But man, these days I'm thinking there's a whole lot of wisdom to, like, maybe not formal catechesis where you're sitting down at the same exact time doing, you know, memorizing these things. I mean, that stuff is important, but it can even look like at around the dinner table saying, hey, I was listening to this podcast. I was listening to my favorite podcast on the 1517 Network, Faith and Reason Exchange. And I was watching Bruce Hillman on Twitter/X and Grayspace, whatever. And they said they were talking about this. What do you think about it? It could be something as simple as that. But if it's not,
who saw this at years ago and tried to do exactly what you're saying was Francis Schaeffer.
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking that too.
Well, even liturgical rhythms, you know, the church year calendar, like today's Wednesday. I assume Scott and Caleb are going to be skiing.
I will not be skiing tonight.
I'm playing with you here, but, you know, I'm thinking it's Wednesday morning for me. I've got jiu-jitsu tonight, but I don't go to jiu-jitsu on Wednesday night during Lent because there are Lent services. And as much as my body's achy, but I want to go do that because I'm addicted to it, right? I know I've got to get to church and I've got to bring my kids to church so that even though there actually isn't usually grumbling, but just so that this, we're in this rhythm.
Yeah. Because
like 99% of the time, you're in the realm of the world, which is the realm of the law. We need, you know, the law is ever present. And there's only one place I'm going to get to the gospel, and that's where the word is preached, whether it's from a pulpit or from the mouth of a father or a mother.
Wow, it's like you're reading out of Being Dad.
This has been one big advertisement.
Never heard of it. What is that? Lots of stars.
No, I was going to say, the one thing I was going to say, it must be nice to have a full-time pastor.
Yeah. But I'm also thinking, like, you know, our listeners, I don't know, you know, we don't know what sort of lives they live and so on. How fortunate are we? I mean, that this is our life, is talking about this stuff.
Right.
Talking about this, reading this stuff. And so, in a way, we have kind of a, you know, if you will, a privileged kind of position, but,
yeah, it does feel, you know, it's like when you're like, you know, just be comfortable talking about theology. It's only what I do for a living.
You don't need to bring people to the dinner table as I do. No, just kidding. It could just be casual, that drive to the soccer game.
Yeah, I mean, I would say when my kids were growing up, a lot of these talks happened as we were driving.
Yeah, I think in the car.
Captive audience style.
I think this is where Schaefer is important, practically.
I agree, actually.
You can only give out of what you have. So if you don't know the Christian story and you don't have any theological foundation, you don't have any background, and you don't make time to try to improve that somewhere. And I'm not talking, and Schaefer wasn't either, like a fully academic education, but just sort of the catechismal deep understandings of the faith and how that works into the big story that God is telling about us and the world and himself. Like if you don't have a good grasp of that, then you can't bring it to the dinner table or the soccer game.
Right.
And so one of the things he was trying to do was trying to show people that how important it was to get that education, but it doesn't have to be like the education you get in a classroom, but you do need to have it. And I think a lot of what we see in modern society is even among Christians who kind of attended church their whole life, they just haven't been fed. And I don't even blame this on the pastor, because I think a lot of pastors try, but just for whatever reason, like they just haven't received or understood or by osmosis or whatever the word would be, like a good grasp on the Christian story. And I mean, most people probably couldn't tell you the relationship between law and gospel or sin and grace in their own words. You know, they might be able to quote something to you, but like, really understanding it. I mean, that was my experience as a pastor. A lot of people couldn't do that. And it was always surprising to me. And so I think it's an encouragement for people too. Like Adam, you're saying, make the time to go to the Lenten service. It's good for your kids and your family. Also make the time to just inform yourself about the basics tenets of the Christian faith and test yourself and see like, can I put this in my own words? Or am I relying on phrases and...
Yeah, cliches, basically.
So yeah, cliches. Yeah,
that's a better way to put it. Yeah. And it's not, it's never too late to start, but the latest studies suggest that they call it the, 4 to 14 window?
Yeah.
Children between the ages of 4 and 14, if they have not sort of taken the faith as their own, it's highly likely when they leave church, when they go off to college or wherever when they get away from their parents' supervision, they're gone and gone for good. I mean, that's a real dour way to kind of come to an end. Somebody say something positive. Scott, positive.
I mean, the fact is that between the ages of 4 and 14 are the ideal times to hit this with kids. And that's a 10-year period.
It's a pretty big window.
That's a decade-long of influence that you have that the data shows is highly successful. But there's also quite a bit that can go on after that. If your kids are older than that, if you're very intentional about going at it and educating. And here's the deal. We can always state all of this. And what we're giving is our opinions and perspectives on information that we're kind of going through at the moment. And one of the great things about 1517 is that we're able to, through the generosity of our donors, employ people like Bruce and Adam, whose time is really dedicated in a lot of ways to studying these things and to wrestling with them and then writing about them or making videos about them or doing a podcast on them to try to explain them to you. But all that being said, what we have in the promises of the scripture is that, you know, as I was kind of alluding to earlier, is that there is this ultimate truth that we encounter most frequently on Sunday mornings when a pastor gets up in front of us and through the absolution forgives our sins, through the preaching of the word gives us God's law and his gospel, as Bruce was talking about, and through the administration of the sacraments hands over the gifts. And it's in that preaching and in that absolution and in those sacraments that God promises to come to us with the power of the Holy Spirit to create faith and to sustain faith. And it doesn't matter how old you are. That miracle that the Holy Spirit performs in turning hearts of stones to hearts of flesh and keeping them beating throughout life and to the end so that when we do pass from this mortal flesh and open our eyes again in glory, we open our eyes to the eyes of the Savior because that word was passed along to us. So never stop passing along that word. Never stop absolving sins.
It's never too late for people. The Holy Spirit doesn't know or doesn't care about the data that our sociologists are putting together that tells us the ideal periods. He works when and will it pleases him, and he will do that, but we preach it, and he works through it. There you go, Adam.
Thank you. I'm starting to feel down.
Well, cool, guys. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinking Fellows podcast. We hope that you enjoyed it, found it useful, helpful, just a good conversation to listen to. If you are enjoying this show, go ahead and check out some of those other shows on the podcast network. I think you will like them very much. If you like the flavor of this episode, Adam's already said it a million times, but I'll say it again. You can listen to Faith and Reason Exchange. I'm on the Outlaw God podcast with Stephen Paulson. My dad's on Tough Texts and 30 Minutes of the New Testament. Bruce is on Twitter on the 1517. So go ahead and check those platforms out. I'm sure there's stuff that you'll find useful and engaging there. We will catch you next week. Bye.